Hello, everybody. Welcome to Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Top Cow Thursday episode, and today I'm going to be continuing the chronology by talking about Arcanum number 2. It's from writer, artist, and he also did some of the inks, Brandon Peterson. This is his creator-owned property that was over at Top Cow. We have inks from Art Tabert and Sean Parsons. Colors are by Richard Eisenov. We have 3D backgrounds by Leia Mai Nguyen. And letters by Dennis Heisler and Robin Spihar, ink assist by Victor Lamas, and we have Greg Hammond and Matt Nelson on color assist. So last time we talked about the first issue of Arcanum and about how there are these ancient avatars, these people who don't know that they are something more than human, and at some point they manifest their powers. And last issue, Ming was the avatar who newly had discovered her powers, and it seemed like there are different factions of avatars, and they were fighting over Ming, who is this new avatar of life. For her part, Ming Chang feels completely overwhelmed. She's a bit frustrated. She's a bit sad. Everything she's ever known about her life and the people that she cares about is basically over at this point. And she's got to completely start over. And not only that, but again, there are these people she doesn't know and doesn't necessarily trust fighting over her like she's a piece of property. Clearly, it's some kind of magical war, an ancient war that has been going on for a really long time. And you feel like, or you get the impression from kind of the tone of the story and the mood that Brandon Peterson sets, that this has been a war that's been waging for a long, long time. So I'm going to go over issue 2 in its entirety here in a second, but just a quick reminder what the Top Cow Chronology Project is. On past episodes, I've gone into great detail, and you can go back and listen to those. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail here. Suffice it to say that I've been a Top Cow fan for quite a while. But I had never read the really old classic Top Cow stuff from the 90s, Witchblade and the Darkness and all that. And so I was searching for a good reading order online, and I came across this reading order from a user that goes by the name of Condor. And his reading order was posted on the Comic Vine website. And what I really liked about it was that it wasn't a reading order in terms of publication history, but it was actually in terms of how to read it so that it made the most sense, so that it marched forward in time with the earliest stories in the reading order taking place in ancient times and moving up to modern times. So there's a link in the show notes if you want to go and check out the chronology. We express our gratitude for Condor for all his hard work. There are tons and tons and tons of books to read. I don't know if I'll ever finish it in my lifetime, because we read a book and then we immediately talk about it, so that it's fresh in our minds. So again, if you want to pick up some of the books in the chronology, they're not terribly expensive. A lot of this 90s stuff can be found in bargain bins or on eBay. A lot of the more mainstream Top Cow stuff, the Witchblade and Darkness, a lot of the Artifact books and titles are available digitally from Comixology or in trade. Some of the more obscure stuff may not be, just because honestly, it probably doesn't sell. But again, you can track the books down if you want. I really encourage people to pay attention when Top Cow has sales, either on Comixology or when they do Humble Bundles. That's by far, like, Humble Bundle is the cheapest way to get digital comics ever, whether it's from Top Cow or other publishers. Whenever they do those Humble Bundles, it's always a really great deal. So let me go ahead and dive into issue 2 here. And as I mentioned, Ming Chang was being pursued by one faction of these avatars, and another faction was trying to keep her safe. And Ramat Nasir basically rescued her from the faction that was looking to exploit her. It seemed to be the bad guys, but again, we're limited in our knowledge, so it's really hard to tell at this point. But what we do know is Nasir basically stopped her from being kidnapped by these golems and took her to a club of all places, a dance club in Santa Monica, California, called the Asylum. So Blake and his minions show up soon after, and they give Nasir an ultimatum to turn over Ming to him and basically beg for his life. Ramat says, don't you realize where we are? We're in the asylum. You can't do anything in here. Even you wouldn't dare cross him. And Ming's very confused, like saying, who are they? I've never seen him before in my life. And Ramat's telling him, well, Franklin Blake and his avatars, they're the ones that have been trying to kill you or capture you. And again, Ming's very confused, like, why would they be doing that? And Ramat explains, well, it's because power. They have power and they're cowards, basically. They're petty and they believe anyone else who has power is a threat to them, someone who's eventually going to take the power away from them. So they try to prevent any people from becoming avatars. And Ming still doesn't get it. She's like, I what power? Why is he attacking us? And Blake apologizes, saying, yeah, I'm sorry, Ming Chang, for what I do now. It really sucks to be killed when you don't even know the reason why. And just as his other avatars, his other soldiers are about to attack, we see a figure in shadow say there will be no deaths here today. Not here, not ever. And he challenges Franklin Blake, saying, you've broken the rule of asylum. Leave now or pay the price in blood. And apparently this guy's name is the Baron, because Franklin says, you don't scare me, Baron. You can't kill me. You can't take an avatar's life before its time. So before it's an avatar is destined to die, I suppose. Although how Blake knows he's not destined to die at this moment is maybe a story for another day. Anyway, Blake goes on to say, Royale has told me your weakness. And Royale would be Matthew Royale, who seems to be someone who works for Blake. Although in this issue, we may be seeing something that it may be the other way around. There are hints, there are clues that when it comes to the relationship between Blake and Royale, it might not be the way Blake sees it. It may be that the relationship runs in the other direction and Blake himself doesn't even realize that yet. But when the Baron hears that Blake knows his weakness, he kind of scoffs at that and he pulls his sunglasses down a little, actually takes them off completely and says, my weakness? Why don't you stare into these eyes? Do you see any pity, any mercy, any weakness, anything but a man who's known nothing but death? And he basically banishes them from the asylum, and they disappear. And as Blake disappears, he says, this isn't over, Nasir. I'll see you dead. And Ming thinks that they've been killed by Baron. They says, oh my God, he killed them. And Ramat says, no, he banished them. And then he goes on to tell Ming, don't be alarmed. This is the reason that I brought you here. This is the Baron. He's Lord of the Asylum. And Ramat thanks Baron for what he just did. But the Baron doesn't want to hear it. He says, stand away from her. I'm sworn to be neutral, and I can't have you giving her any further aid. And he tells Ming to come with him. And Ming's like, what do you mean, come with you? You think I'm crazy? And Nasir says, don't worry. It's not your time yet. And Nasir takes her through a door and says he wants to show her the rest of Asylum. So when they get through the door, they're now in kind of the back part of the Asylum, the part that doesn't resemble just your everyday dance club. And Ming's first response is, there's no way all these huge chambers and space would fit inside the club that we saw. And the Baron says, well, no, because Asylum exists in several places at once. And so because of that, it's magic. It's not bound by the laws of physics. And almost every large city in the world has a passage that leads to Asylum. And they're all disguised as clubs. And they're only accessible by myself and those that I specifically grant access to. And as Ming looks around, she says, well, why are all these people here? And Baron says, well, these are people who've been given magic, like you have, but they have fought its influence. They don't want to fully accept it, so they live here to be safe. And Ming says, well, magic, you mean like Siegfried and Roy magic, or magic like Merlin magic? And the Baron says, like Merlin. It's, magic is a powerful force. It flows over the world like a quiet storm, and men have harnessed its energy for ages, which is fitting, as it's powered by man. It's powered by men's belief. And Baron says just that. Magic is fueled by humanity's belief and imagination. as well as its ignorance and fear. It's sort of a dichotomy. It's the creative yin fighting against the destructive yang, and it's always at war with itself. And in that way, it kind of mirrors humanity's dual nature. You know, some of us are good and some of us are bad. But he goes on to say that magic itself has its own mind, right? It's created from the minds, the collective minds of humans, but it's sort of taken on a life of its own. And it chooses how it evolves by means of avatars, normal men and women who have been imbued with a portion of magic, and their actions decide what magic will become. So the avatars, they sort of embody different aspects of the nature of man. And as the magic grows and builds within them, the more it is intense inside them, whatever particular aspects of humanity that avatar represents, then that's sort of the way that magic heads. So you can almost think of them as shepherds, and the more powerful they become, the more they have influence over the overall flock, so to speak. And Ming says, well, this is all a little much. It's a little confusing, and I really can't take this. I just want to go home. It's happening too fast. And Baron says, well, you don't really have a home anymore. It's no longer what you knew. And then he gives her a gift and says, please accept this pendant. It's going to help you focus. It was made by one of us here specifically for you. And so he hands her this pendant that has a green glowing gem on a gold chain. And as she puts it on, Baron says, you know, this pendant will take a portion of your magic, and you can use that portion to protect yourself, as well as create clothing, armor, things like that. And sure enough, as Ming puts it on, all of a sudden she's clothed in this green armor and costume, and the Baron welcomes her as the Avatar of Life and says, Ming Chang, I welcome you to the war. And he goes on to say that it's not a joke. The armor's not a joke. It's part of her magic, and it's made solid by her magic. But if she concentrates, she can recall it. The power will dissipate, and it will go back inside of her, basically. So then Baron says, now onto the rules. And Ming says, rules? Wait, what do you mean, rules? And the Baron says, yes, there are only a couple, but they're sacred. So the magic's going to try to force you to one extreme or the other. It's going to feed off your nature until you're either a force of light or a force of darkness, which is probably why all those other beings were staying inside the asylum, so they don't have to choose. Maybe they don't want to pick a side, they don't want to be on the losing side, whatever it might be. But the Baron said eventually those two factions of avatars are going to do battle, right? And the victor is going to be the group that gets to decide what the next era of man will be like, whether that's shaping it into an enlightened age or a dark age. It seems to be what these factions are fighting over. They're fighting over control. And so the Baron tells Ming that she's also no longer encumbered by things like aging or disease or any infirmities. The only way she can die is by violence, and she can only truly die if another avatar kills her. So you can almost think of it as selective immortality in a way. And Ming is trying to take all this in, and she's saying, yeah, I really don't understand any of this. Can I just stay here? And the Baron says, no, you cannot. You're welcome to return, but only if you can return and walk that thin gray line between the light and the dark, which is what the other people that are there in asylum must be doing. I suppose you kind of have to understand and know the world before you can choose to be able to stay in the middle and be neutral. The Baron goes on to say, I don't let the conflict enter the asylum. As the arbiter, I've made that my personal provision. And Ming says, well, what makes you special? What am I supposed to do now? The life I knew was over. And Baron introduces her to the rest of the avatars that we met previously. And he tells Ming, well, you can find a new life with them or on your own. It's up to you. So again, these are the four avatars that we saw in the half issue and also in issue one. and they introduce themselves by name to Ming Chang. We have Georgi Milovich, we have Marie Eisenov, we have Ramat Nasir, and Luis Benitez. So now that the Baron has sort of explained the rules to her, he tells Ming that now it's time for her to go, and she should hope that they don't meet again soon, because if they do, that probably means that Ming's time is up, and it's time for her to be killed. So the rest of the avatars take Ming to an alley where there's some graffiti, and it's actually a special gate that they're able to use their avatar's powers to unlock and walk through. What they don't realize is that they're being spied on. That hunter from the half issue, Hawk, is lurking in the shadows, and he sees them go through the gate, and we can only imagine he's going to report back to his superiors. Meanwhile, the avatars are a bit discombobulated, a bit disoriented, especially Luis Benitez. And we learn that this is actually sort of the base of the rebellious avatars. They call it the Rebellion. Although I don't know that necessarily fits. They also refer to it as a religious group of mages. It's basically the faction that's aligned against Franklin and Franklin Blake and his avatars. And throughout the second issue, we still don't really understand why they're at odds. Like, what are their beliefs that have them fighting against each other? We know it has to do with power and who gets to make the next choice in terms of steering magic forward for the next era of man. But what does that mean exactly? Does that mean that Franklin Blake wants to hoard all the magic himself and these others want to share magic? We're not really sure. And it gets pretty dialogue heavy here. There's a lot of explanation from Quentin, who's the leader of this religious group of mages, as Nassar introduces him. And he gives an explanation of what the base is. It's sort of this technological marvel, but at the same time, it's sort of cobbled together from a bunch of different pieces. And Ming's surprised. She's like, why is everything computerized if you guys are magicians? And Quentin explains, well, if you'd rather pick your way through pig entrails or boil kettles of bat's breath, you know, that's so last century. This is the 20th century, and so we use modern tools. And so it's kind of interesting to think about this cross between modern technology and magic, basically. And Quentin goes on to say that the leader of the Thurgist, which basically is Blake and his followers, Blake's himself is 800 years old and he's a Luddite. So why wouldn't he kind of choose to ignore technology and embrace magic? Whereas it seems like Quentin and his followers are trying to marry the two together. So meanwhile, we see Hawk does indeed report back that he saw all of the avatars head into this pocket universe where their base is. But Blake is not there. So Hawk reports to Royale and says, am I back in your good graces? And Royale says, my graces? What are you talking about? Franklin Blake leads this group. I'm just a servant. And Hawk says, you know what? I've been a hunter for a long time. And you know, I can spot predator versus prey, sir. And you are actually the leader of the pack. And Blake says, very well, return here. And you know, I'll give you further instructions. And then Royal thinks to himself, well, that's a surprise that Hawk is the first one to have figured it out, because apparently he really does have some plans. And he says, by the time that anyone else figures it out, it will probably be too late, and I'll have the prize that I've waited 800 years to claim. Meanwhile, in Westchester County, New York, at the headquarters of Cyberforce, we see that there's been a big fire due to a massive power spike while one of the members of Cyberforce was surfing the internet, and it blew out all their circus relays. And I imagine we might see Cyberforce show up in the pages of Arcanum soon. So just a little nod here, letting us know that yes, they are indeed in the same universe. They take place in the same universe. So Ming Chang is getting some rest in the base when all of a sudden they're attacked by these golems, which are the same sort of soldiers of Franklin Blake that we saw attack Ming Chang and try to kidnap her in the first issue. And not only are they there to try to kidnap Ming, but they're also there to destroy this base now that they realize that their opponents have this other base kind of hidden in cyberspace, for lack of a better place to call it. And the golems are successful in destroying all the anchors that keep the base in place. And the issue ends with Ming Chang being taken to Athenium Thurgical, which is the home base of Franklin Blake and all of his followers. How she went from being sleeping in a bed in the other base to being captured, we're not really sure. But what we do know is she's really not in a good place because she doesn't yet understand how to fully use her powers or even really manifest them. So it would seem to me for issue 3 that the rest of the avatars are going to have to mount a rescue to try to spring a Ming from this this cell that she's being held in inside Franklin Blake's base. As far as the artwork for the issue, it's very 90s. You know, this issue came out in 97, and I think that Peterson's art is much more calm now. But again, during the time of the 90s, this art would have fit right in. It's kind of dynamic. It's kind of busy. Things tend to be a little exaggerated in terms of anatomy and such. And so it's not bad art by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just very much of its time. The same could be said of the colors. Although this isn't a traditional superhero comic, this is the early days of digital coloring. And while it's colored well by Richard Eisenhoff, the depth of color, the saturation, tends to be a little heavy in my mind. And again, it sort of dates the book because you, just by looking at it, you can kind of tell, okay, well, this book was made in the 90s based on the art style and the colors. Again, I'm not saying it's bad art by any stretch of the imagination. The storytelling from panel to panel is pretty good. This is much more of a talking heads issue as opposed to last issue where we got a lot of action. In this issue, we don't get almost any action at all. Just right at the end for a couple of pages when the golems attack the rebel base. But the story does flow very well. It's clear that Brandon Peterson is talented. The pacing is pretty good. The dialogue, especially for being the 90s, holds up surprisingly well. Like I said, it does get a little wordy right in the middle when Quentin is sort of explaining to Ming Chang the rules. And we got that a little bit earlier in the issue when the Baron was doing the same thing, explaining the rules of asylum to Ming. And so it's not that it's just being explained to Ming, but she's sort of our POV character, right? She's our window into this world. As she discovers this world and what's going on, we're discovering it right along with her. So it's entertaining. It's not the best comic. It's not the best story. It's not the best concept that I've ever seen. And part of that would be just based on the time period that it came out. It's interesting that before the 90s and when all of a sudden artists started getting just as much credit, if not more, than writers for the first time ever in the history of comics and probably the only time since, all of a sudden that was sort of the change that marked bigger panels, less, maybe not in this particular instance, but typically less words. But so this was, I really feel like, a step toward what we have now in modern comics, where you have a lot less dialogue. You are getting bigger panels, more detailed art, and writers and artists are collaborating more to tell a story, both with words and pictures, as opposed to older comics where the pictures were there, but they almost were additive to the scripting and the dialogue and the exposition that was already there. They might go through, you know, and have a little dialogue box or exposition box that gave you know, a whole rundown on your setting and your background. That doesn't happen so much nowadays. The artist will just illustrate it, and they'll leave it to you, the reader, to how much you want to look into that and guess where it is and draw from the setting and things like that. So this is that transitional period, the late 90s from maybe 96 to about 2002, I would say, when comics is trying to find its footing and where's the balance between words and pictures. And this is right there in that time period. So it kind of has a little bit of both, right? There's still tons of words, tons of dialogue boxes, tons of exposition, again, as these different characters are explaining to Ming Chang, what is going on? What's this new world she's been introduced to? But we're also getting art that has a little more detail. The panels are a bit bigger. The colors are brighter. You know, the printing process is better. So in that way, like I said, this comics of this time period sort of bridge that gap between the old and the new, if you will. So I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Source Podcast. As I mentioned before, Arcanum, it's not the best series, but it is entertaining. And there's a few issues to go. I think six more. I think the series ran for 8 issues total. And I'll definitely be covering more of the issues on future Top Cow Chronology episodes. So just another reminder, you can go to the show notes. You can find the link to the chronology from Condor on the Comic Vine website. If you want to go and follow along, either move back to the beginning of the chronology if you want to start reading things to get caught up where we are, or maybe you just want to know what's coming up next so you can try to track down the books and read along with us. We really appreciate that as well. We also appreciate reviews. We're really trying to get our numbers up so we can bring you more exclusives, more interviews, more content. All that stuff is contingent upon access to publishers and their PR departments. And they always want to know what our circulation is and what our download numbers are and all that kind of stuff. So we really appreciate everybody who goes over to either Stitcher or Apple and gives us a review, especially 5-star reviews. I cannot stress enough how much they help out. And if you could get your friends, even if they don't listen, if you can get your friends to go and leave positive reviews as well, 5-star reviews, that'd be great. Obviously, we want them to listen, but again, getting the podcast in front of as many people as we can so they can learn about this stuff, read about the joys of comics, listen along with us. We really appreciate all the support that you guys have given us over the last year. Numbers continue to get better and grow, but there's always room to keep climbing. So again, we really appreciate everybody's support and giving us those ratings on Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever you listen to us on. It really, really helps out. I can't stress it enough. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.